KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We searched approximately 364 properties in the Altadena area, and unfortunately during that search, we did locate three deceased. As these searches continue, I unfortunately anticipate that those numbers will increase.
Devastating wildfires in Los Angeles have killed at least 24 people, with dozens more missing. As the region braces for more dangerous winds, we'll talk about the historically black Altadena community, where Octavia Butler, the writer, is buried. It's been ravaged by the fires. We'll speak to Los Angeles journalist Sonali Kohatkar, who had to evacuate her home, and California climate researcher Leah Stokes. Then to Gaza, where Palestinian journalists are criticizing the lack of support from international media organizations.
We are just documenting a genocide against us. It's enough after almost a year and a half. We want you to stand foot by foot with us, because we are like any other journalists, reporters, and media workers all across the globe, no matter the origin, the color, or the race. Journalism is not a crime. We are not a target.
We'll speak with Palestinian reporter Abu Bakr Abed in Gaza. Then, as Poland reverses course and says it will not arrest Prime Minister Netanyahu under the ICC warrant if he attends the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz this month, we'll go to Brussels to the Hind Rajab Foundation. It's leading the effort to hold individual Israeli soldiers accountable for war crimes and making it very difficult for IDF soldiers who fought in Gaza to travel outside Israel. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from the fires in Los Angeles has risen to 24, with dozens of people still missing. More than 12,000 homes and other structures have been destroyed or damaged as firefighters continue to battle the Eaton, Palisades, and Hearst fires. Los Angeles County Fire Chief Anthony Marone says the risk of new fires remains high.
Elevated critical fire weather conditions will continue through Wednesday. Please rest assured that your County of Los Angeles Fire Department will be prepared. These winds, combined with low humidities and low fuel moistures, will keep the fire threat in all of Los Angeles County very high.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and Los Angeles County have both declared public health emergencies due to the smoke and particulate matter from the ongoing wildfires. Meanwhile, the Mexican president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has sent a team of Mexican firefighters to Los Angeles. Laura Vasquez Azua is the head of Mexico's civil protection.
We will stay as long as necessary. We will support in a spirit of solidarity and with all our experience and commitment to the people of California.
As of Friday, nearly 1,000 incarcerated firefighters have also been deployed to help fight the LA fires. According to state officials, the incarcerated firefighters are paid a daily rate of between $5.80 to $10.24. That's a daily rate. Meanwhile, many wealthy residents in Los Angeles are hiring private firefighters who cost as much as $2,000 an hour to protect their property. Authorities in Gaza say more than 5,000 Palestinians were killed or went missing in the first 100 days of Israel's siege on northern Gaza, which began in early October. Another 9,500 Palestinians have been injured and 2,600 have been detained. In a statement, Gaza's government media office said, quote, in the past 100 days, our people in northern Gaza have suffered the most horrific forms of killing, ethnic cleansing, destruction, and displacement, unquote. This comes as talks continue over a possible ceasefire and hostage deal. Reuters reports Qatar gave Israel and Hamas a final draft of a deal earlier today. President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke on Sunday, but Israel's continuing to attack Gaza. Earlier today, Israel bombed a school in Gaza City, killing 5 displaced Palestinians. On Saturday, Israel struck a school in the Jabalia refugee camp, killing at least 8 people, including 2 children and 2 women. On Saturday, a funeral was held for the Palestinian journalist Syed Abu Naban, who was shot dead by Israeli forces Friday. He was a freelance cameraman for the Andalou news agency. This is his colleague, Mohammed Abu Namous.
It is clear that the Israeli occupation wants to target the journalist body that exposes its crimes. While the occupation has utilized its media to say that they only target the resistance and their weapons until the Palestinian journalists have exposed the truth to the world, saying this occupation targets children, women, and unarmed civilians.
Meanwhile, the government of Poland has adopted a resolution to protect Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from arrest if he attends a major event in Poland this month to mark 80 years since the liberation of the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz. In November, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Netanyahu for war crimes in Gaza. At first, Poland said it would honor the warrant and arrest Netanyahu if he came to Poland. On Friday, New York judge Juan Merchan sentenced President-elect Donald Trump to an unconditional discharge in Trump's 2016 election subversion hush money case. This means Trump will avoid jail time or probation despite being convicted by a jury on 34 felony charges. It also means Trump will enter the White House as the first president with a felony conviction. This is Judge Merchan.
After careful analysis, in obedience to governing mandates and pursuant to the rule of law, this court has determined that the only lawful sentence that permits entry of a judgment of conviction without encroaching upon the highest office in the land is an unconditional discharge, which the New York State Legislature has determined is a lawful and permissible sentence for the crime of falsifying business records in the first degree.
Donald Trump appeared before the judge remotely and criticized the sentence.
It's been a political witch hunt. It was done to damage my reputation so that I'd lose the election, and obviously that didn't work. And the people of our country got to see this firsthand because they watched the case in your courtroom.
In other Trump news, special counsel Jack Smith has resigned from the Department of Justice. This comes as Trump continues to fight to block the release of Smith's final report on his criminal investigations into Trump. Senate confirmation hearings for Trump's nominees begin Tuesday when the Senate Armed Services Committee considers Pete Hegseth, the Fox News host tapped by Trump to become defense secretary. Hegseth will likely face questions over accusations that he raped a woman in 2017 at a Republican women's conference in Monterey, California. He claimed the encounter was consensual, but he later paid the woman as part of a non-disclosure agreement. Hegseth's own mother has called him, quote, an abuser of women, unquote. Also on Tuesday, confirmation hearings will be held for Interior Secretary nominee Doug Burgum and Veterans Affairs Secretary nominee Doug Collins. The U.S. Supreme Court appears poised to uphold a law that would ban TikTok starting January 19th and lets its Chinese parent company ByteDance sells it to a U.S. buyer. Backers of the TikTok ban claim the popular social media app, which has some 170 million users in the U.S. alone, is a national security risk. Critics of the ban say it's motivated by anti-Chinese sentiment and warn it threatens the livelihoods of many content creators and small business owners who rely on TikTok. In more Supreme Court news, the justices agreed to review the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act's no-cost coverage for a number of preventive care services, including some cancer screenings, HIV prevention drugs, and heart statins. Sudan says its military has recaptured the key city of Wad Madani from the paramilitary rapid support forces. Wad Madani, the capital of Gezira province, fell to the RSF over a year ago. The devastating 21-month civil war has killed over 28,000 people and displaced more than 11 million. The UN says famine in Sudan has now spread to five regions with over 750,000 people on the brink of starvation. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders announced Friday it's suspending operations at one of Khartoum's main hospitals after its workers repeatedly came under attack. The Prime Minister of Greenland says he's open to dialogue with incoming U.S. President Trump, but maintained Greenland is focused on its independence amidst Trump's continued threats to take control over the territory. This is Prime Minister Mutha Biaya.
Ønsket om selvstændighed, ønsket om at være her i eget hus.
The desire for independence, the desire to be in one's own house, is probably understood by all people in the world. And that struggle from Greenland's side isn't new. It didn't just happen yesterday. It didn't happen when I gave the New Year's speech. But things have developed in that direction for many, many years, at least for many decades. We don't want to be Danes. We don't want to be Americans. We want to be Greenlandic. And of course, it is the Greenlandic people who decide their future.
Trump's threats towards Greenland have shown a spotlight on the territory's push to gain full independence from Denmark, which has long been accused of committing colonial abuses against its mostly Inuit population. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro was sworn in for a third term Friday in a ceremony held 5 months after a controversial election that the opposition claimed to have won. A number of Latin American leaders skipped Maduro's inauguration, including Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva, the president of Brazil, and Gustavo Petro of Colombia. The inauguration ceremony was held a day after the Venezuelan opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, was briefly detained. As Maduro was sworn in, the Biden administration announced it would offer a $25 million reward for information leading to Maduro's arrest. The Biden administration's extended temporary protected status for immigrants from Venezuela, El Salvador, Ukraine, and Sudan for 18 months. The relief shields people from deportation, though it doesn't provide a path to citizenship. Immigration officials have postponed a planned check-in with the New York immigrant rights leader, Ravi Ravier, who feared he could soon be deported. The check-in, which was scheduled for today, has been pushed back until mid-March. This comes as Ravier is seeking a presidential pardon before Biden leaves office in a week. Visit democracynow.org to see our interview with Ravi Ravier on Friday. The Justice Department concluded the 1921 Tulsa race massacre was a coordinated military-style attack as the agency released the findings of its investigation announced last fall. On May 31 and June 1st of 1921, white rioters murdered an estimated 300 black residents of Tulsa, Oklahoma's Greenwood neighborhood known as Black Wall Street and looted and destroyed their homes and businesses. The report also states there are no living perpetrators for the Justice Department to prosecute. The last remaining survivors of the Tulsa race massacre, Viola Fletcher and Lessie Benningfield Randall, both 110 years old, have been seeking justice and reparation for years. Last year, the Oklahoma Supreme Court dismissed their case. A Columbia Law School professor who vocally defended students after they faced persecution from Columbia for protesting in support of Palestinian rights says she was terminated after 25 years on her job. Catherine Franke accused Columbia's administration of creating a toxic and hostile environment for debate and of failing to protect its students and faculty. Colombia was at the center of a firestorm around campus protests for Gaza last year after it violently cracked down on student demonstrations, called in the New York police to dismantle a peaceful encampment. Former Colombia President Manuza Fick, who last year also gave a disastrous congressional testimony on Capitol Hill, ultimately resigned. UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese decried Frankie's termination, saying she was, quote, yet another victim of the pro-Israelism that is turning universities and other spaces of public life into places of obscurantism, discrimination, and oppression, unquote. To see our interviews with Catherine Franke about this case and more, go to democracynow.org. And the founder of the Young Lords, Jose Chacha Jimenez, has died at the age of 76. In the 1960s, Jimenez turned a Chicago street gang into a Puerto Rican political organization inspired by the Black Panthers.
So the Young Lords were a gang in the Lincoln Park neighborhood that first came in there and was being beaten up by other existing ethnic gangs at first, and felt the need to organize. So they were a gang. And then in 1968, we reorganized. I was the president of the group then, and I kind of led. I was a catalyst for reorganizing the group into a political movement, modeled after the Black Panther Party because we wanted the same concept, but in the Puerto Rican community.
After starting in Chicago, the Young Lords would expand to New York and other cities. Chacha Jimenez also worked closely with Black Panther Fred Hampton before Hampton was assassinated by the FBI in 1969. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Los Angeles, where at least 24 people have been killed in devastating fires that have scorched and flattened entire communities over the last week. Dozens of people are still missing. The fires have burned over 40,000 acres and forced some 150,000 people to evacuate, while an estimated 12,000 homes and other structures have been destroyed or severely damaged. This is Los Angeles County Sheriff Robert Luna.
Yesterday, we started a search and rescue operation out in the Eaton area, where in the first day of this operation, grid searching, we searched approximately 364 properties in the Altadena area. And unfortunately, during that search, we did locate three deceased. As these searches continue, I unfortunately anticipate that those numbers will increase.
Firefighting crews continue to battle three active blazes in the Los Angeles area, making progress over the weekend against the two biggest fires, Palisades and Eaton. But authorities warn of a new wave of strong winds expected to return to the area this week. Los Angeles County Fire Chief Anthony Marone says the risk of new fires remains high.
Elevated critical fire weather conditions will continue through Wednesday. Please rest assured that your County of Los Angeles Fire Department will be prepared. These winds, combined with low humidities and low fuel moistures, will keep the fire threat in all of Los Angeles County very high.
As of Friday, nearly 1,000 incarcerated firefighters had also been deployed to battle catastrophic fires, working around the clock, with some making as little as between $5.80 to $10.24 a day. Meanwhile, wealthy residents in Los Angeles are hiring private firefighters who cost as much as $2,000 an hour to protect their property. Mexico has also sent firefighting personnel to help contain the L.A. fires. Laura Vasquez Alzua is the head of Mexico's civil protection.
We will stay as long as necessary. We will support in a spirit of solidarity and with all our experience and commitment to the people of California.
This comes as the U.S. Health and Human Services Department and Los Angeles County have been both declared public health emergencies due to the smoke and particulate matter from the ongoing fires. Despite that, many schools located outside mandatory evacuation zones are scheduled to reopen today. For more, we're joined by two guests. U.S. Sonali Kohatkar is an award-winning journalist and author and host of the radio and TV show Rising Up with Sonali. Her forthcoming book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible. She's in Pasadena and had to evacuate. And Leah Stokes is with us, an associate professor of environmental politics at the University of California, Santa Barbara, researcher on climate and energy policy. We're going to go first to Sonali. Sonali, we spoke to you last week, just after you evacuated your family, your parents, your kids. Can you talk about what you went through this weekend? Is your house still standing? And what about your community?
Thank you so much, Amy. I appreciate that you had me on. In the midst of my evacuation, I last spoke to you from a hotel I had evacuated to. Friday morning, I returned to my home with my family. I am one of the lucky ones whose home is still standing. My husband and I went and checked on it. This house was very well sealed, and my elderly parents, who are disabled, it was very hard for them to remain evacuated. They hadn't showered in days. And their house, which is right behind mine, is relatively new. So we made the decision to bring them back. And, had been covering the every square foot we could with air purifiers in our house, wearing respirator masks until the air indoors subsided and the quality increased and improved. We had to make sure that we were stocked up on bottled water because we're being told that out of some caution, the water should not be consumed for any kind of drinking or brushing teeth. So we had to make sure we had enough water. And it has been, the air inside smelled of smoke for a while. Now it's subsided quite a bit. We're staying mostly indoors, although I've been walking around my community and trying to capture the stories of people who've lost everything. On Friday afternoon already, there were crews of young people who were kind of deputized, if you will, by the Pasadena Job Center, which is basically a day laborer center here in Pasadena, to go around and help people clean up debris. People in Altadena, so I live like 1.5 blocks south of the border with Altadena, that border is being completely barricaded and policed by local law enforcement, the sheriff's department, and National Guard. And so anybody who wanted to go into Altadena to clean up couldn't. So North Pasadena sort of benefited from their volunteer efforts. A crew of young people came into my backyard, cleared up all the debris, and bagged it in 2 hours. So that helps mitigate any future danger from fires that we might expect this week. I mean, it's been quite remarkable to see my community rise up. There's donation centers popping up spontaneously every couple of blocks. But there's also this grim reality, where I'm driving west on Woodbury Avenue, and on the right, there are law enforcement standing, just preventing people from going. And on the left, there's members of the community who are helping one another. And those are such starkly different realities. There's a curfew in place in Altadena and the evacuation zone. So anybody who's caught walking outside in Altadena after 6 p.m., even if they live there, is being arrested. And every day those barricades are coming further and further and further, one block south into North Pasadena. So it does feel like we're living in a war zone. There's remarkable resiliency, but there's also this grim sense that, it could happen again. My concern is no one's really strongly linking what's happening now to climate change, because my house may have survived this round of Santa Ana winds. What about the next round next week? Or what about next year and the year after that? So yeah, it's been strange. I'm so lucky. I now know 23 people and counting who have lost their homes. People I saw just days before the fire, and now who have GoFundMe pages set up. It's very devastating.
And can you talk about the community of Altadena, the historically Black community where Octavia Butler is buried?
Yeah. She's buried just a couple of miles from my home. I visited her grave last year. My book club read Parable of the Sower because her book, was written in the 90s, but it opens in July, I believe, is summer 2024. So we sort of read it just a little bit after that. And it is so prescient because it is a post-apocalyptic Southern California around Los Angeles. Octavia Butler called this area her home. The cemetery she's buried at, Mountain View Cemetery, is just on the Altadena side of the border. I drove by there yesterday. There seemed to be a little bit of damage, but the reports that I'm reading, because I still can't go in to Altadena, are that the cemetery was by and large not too damaged. There's a lovely, amazing Black-owned bookstore in North Pasadena called Octavia's Bookshelf, run by Nikki High, a Black resident of Altadena, who has turned her bookstore into a hub, a local hub of donations. I interviewed Nikki. She hasn't even been back home. She thinks her home is standing, and she has just risen up for her community. And I spoke yesterday with Perry Bennett, the owner and proprietor of Perry's Joy, a beloved institution in North Pasadena, who was telling me about the tight-knit Black community in Altadena and Pasadena. And you're right, you know, Altadena is home to about 18% of its population is African-American, so a little bit higher than the general country. And it's, you know, Altadena is a town that was rapidly gentrifying, but that Black community has stayed there for generations. I can count, you know, friends who have lost their family homes. And it's a very tight-knit community. Perry Bennett was telling me yesterday how everybody knows everybody else. Everybody knows their moms and dads and you know, neighbors. And then I encountered four young Black women who were giving away, who had set up a donation hub on someone's front lawn. And they were incredible women who had grown up in North Pasadena, Altadena. Some of them were now going to college elsewhere, but they had come back. Their families were impacted. It's a tight-knit community. It's a community where people have had the chance to own homes because they hadn't been redlined historically. And the people are grieving, wondering if they can rebuild those networks. There's developers already circling around, you know, predatory capitalism waits for no one. Yeah. And they are offering people, you know, offering to buy up their property already. And it's insulting. I mean, the embers haven't even gone cold. The smoke is still rising and the developers are circling.
As Naomi Klein wrote about the shock doctrine, the rise of disaster capitalism, I wanted to turn to the science fiction writer, Octavia Butler, on Democracy Now! Back in 2005. You know, she writes about global warming, about totalitarianism. We were one of the last interviews with her before she died and was buried in Altadena. We spoke after the catastrophic Hurricane Katrina.
I wrote the two parable books back in the 90s, and they are books about, as I said, what happens because we don't trouble to correct some of the problems that we're brewing for ourselves right now. Global warming is one of those problems. And I was aware of it back in the 80s. I was reading books about it. And a lot of people were seeing it as politics, as something very iffy, as something they could ignore because nothing was going to come of it tomorrow. That and the fact that I think I was paying a lot of attention to education because a lot of my friends were teachers, and the politics of education was getting scarier, it seemed to me. We were getting to that point where we were thinking more about the building of prisons than of schools and libraries. And I remember while I was working on the novels, my hometown, Pasadena, had a bond issue that they passed to aid libraries. And I was so happy that it passed because so often these things don't. And they had closed a lot of branch libraries and were able to reopen them. So not everybody was going in the wrong direction, but a lot of the country still was. And what I wanted to write was a novel of someone who was coming up with solutions of a sort.
Prophetic, the Black famous writer, Octavia Butler, back in 2005 from Pasadena, buried in Altadena. As she talked about prison, Sonali, what about the incarcerated firefighters? We went out to California, interviewed them years ago, now making what, between $5 and $10 not an hour, but a day as they risk their lives like other firefighters to fight these blazes.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, there's not very many media outlets that are bringing up that aspect of the firefighting effort in Eaton Canyon and Palisades and all of the fires that have broken out. It is, to me, so indicative of the ways in which our spending priorities are so skewed. Yes, it's true that our fire departments are severely understaffed. So instead of us, you know, training more non-incarcerated people, or for that matter, frankly, allowing incarcerated people to simply not be incarcerated so they can actually be active and, you know, fulfilled members of our society, we turn to prison labor. And prison labor is used in so many different aspects of our capitalist society. Firefighting is one of them. I, you know, personally haven't had the chance to interact with any of the firefighters here because they're in the thick of it, in the throes of fighting the fires. But to me, this is why I talk about how it's important for us to start veering away from policing and in prisons and into keeping us really safe. Incarcerated firefighters are trying to keep us safe, but they themselves are part of the architecture of violence, and they are the victims of the architecture of violence as well. In my new book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World Is Possible, I speak with 12 abolitionists who talk about these very issues, about how we need to start funding the things that truly keep us safe. The climate, right? One of the people I interview is Leah Penniman, who works on food justice issues. Melina Abdullah, who talks about participatory budgeting. The great Gina Dent, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, Dylan Rodriguez, longtime abolitionists, who talk about the importance of pulling money out of policing and the architectures of death making and into the things that keep us safe. Robin D.G. Kelly, who wrote the foreword to the book, who's been on Democracy Now many times. You know, there are people who have been thinking so for so long and strategically about primarily Black leaders and activists who I interview in the book, who have been thinking about how we start applying an abolitionist framework to our economy, to our society. And in such a framework, in such a world, we would not only be climate resilient, we would not only not have incarceration at the mass level that we do now, we would have less crime, we would have fewer fires because we would have dealt with the climate crisis, and we would have more resilient homes, and we would have equity along racial lines. This is the world that we need to manifest and make happen and actually fight for, rather than the apocalyptic promise of racial capitalism and policing and prisons, which is what we're living in right now.
And people can recognize the incarcerated firefighters by their orange jumpsuits. Yes. I want to also bring in Leah Stokes, Associate Professor of Environmental Politics at University of California, Santa Barbara, author of Short Circuiting Policy, co-host of the podcast A Matter of Degrees. Professor Stokes, talk about climate change and what we're seeing today. There's a lot of discussion about individuals responsible for these fires. Almost no discussion. Yes, we hear about the Santa Ana winds, the fierce winds. We hear about the very dry weather. But I mean, what, 1/100th of an inch of rain since beginning of October, when it's usually 4.5 to 5 inches? Can you talk about how climate change contributes to the catastrophe we're seeing in your state?
Absolutely, Amy. You really hit it on the nose there. Who is responsible? It's fossil fuel companies and electric utilities who lied about climate science for decades. And, you know, that's why laws, for example, in Vermont and New York, where they've just passed these Superfund laws to basically hold big polluters accountable to make them pay for these disasters, I can only imagine that California will be thinking about that too. We know that climate change is the main driver here. The fact is that LA County, more than 80% of it is under extreme drought. And we're looking at the driest 20-year period in 1,200 years. And there have been papers, academic, scientific, peer-reviewed papers that are almost 10 years old now, which showed that More than twice the amount of area is burning in California that would have otherwise because of climate change, and that climate change is the main driver of all this dryness. And the other thing that climate change is doing is it's leading to more extreme precipitation and sometimes, and then more extreme dryness, right? And so last year, last sort of wet season, there was an enormous amount of water that fell in Southern California. That led to a lot of new fuel being built up, you know, all this chaparral, the bushes that they grow. And then the next year, which we're in right now, the October period starts that rainy season. When no rain is falling, all of that new fuel, it builds up, it dies. And then when these massive hurricane force winds hit during January, and you have this period of dryness, that overlap of these extreme winds and that dry landscape, that parched drought landscape, that's what creates this tinderbox situation. And in the past, you know, we wouldn't have had the same overlap where you would have had such extreme drought and these winds at the same time. And so that's what's really creating such a dangerous situation for people.
And the Santa Ana winds, if you can explain more, because of course, they are well known, these fierce winds, but this, what is called, I mean, the media will talk about the perfect storm, but not the climate catastrophe and what it would mean to change the way we live.
Yeah, you know, the ultimate driver here is climate change. There's been a lot of reporting that, you know, people can do things to try to protect their homes, you know, things like metal roofs or reducing the amount of vegetation that's close to a building. But how are you supposed to do that in a hurricane force wind when there are embers flying everywhere? You know, if one neighbor their home lights on fire, that just creates a massive fuel source for all the other areas. There are things we can be doing in terms of urban planning, how closely we're building these homes together and whether or not we're building them in this wildland urban interface in places that are more likely to burn. But again, I don't think it's about blaming individual homeowners here or thinking that there's some magical solution for how we can harden infrastructure during red flag warnings, you know, where such extreme confluence of dryness and wind comes together. You know, we're about to go into another one of those experiences just tonight in LA and Ventura County. The fact is that the number one thing we have to do to really get at the root cause of this disease is to stop burning fossil fuels. And people have been saying that for decades, including Octavia Butler, who wrote that extremely prescient book, you know, that didn't just talk about climate change, but also she had forecast that a fascist president came to power in her story on a slogan, a campaign slogan of Make America Great Again. So in these horrible disasters, you know, people can turn away from facts and reality, and that can create even more danger. But what we really need to do is reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. We need to electrify all the buildings that we can, including our infrastructure, our transportation, and that will also make us safer next time. You know, when we're building back these communities, we need to be building them back electric. And we need to be making sure that our infrastructure, like water pumping stations, have backup energy through things like battery and solar backups. That can make sure that we're safer for the next fires.
So let me ask you something, Professor Stokes. Governor Newsom has been saying, you know, I mean, when you consider the scale of the horror, they're going to deregulate so people can build quickly. But what about the problem with this, deregulating what the requirements are? For example, Los Angeles County identified 70% of its burned areas this year as being in very high-risk zones. Do you think that development continuing in these areas is a problem? And the idea that everything has to be even more regulated, considering the causes of climate change.
Yeah, it's really tragic. You know, these communities go back, you know, decades, a century, and people have really long-term relationships with the landscape. But the fact is that the places where they were living, they're becoming less and less safe. And what I can imagine might happen, given what happened in Santa Barbara and Montecito, you know, my community after the Thomas Fire, is that after this horrible months-long fire that affected so many people, we then had half an inch of rain fall in 5 minutes in Montecito, and this is one of the richest zip codes in America. It led to horrible mudslides, which killed people, some, you know, lower-income Hispanic communities, but also very, very wealthy people died in those mudslides. And that is what we will see if we have extreme rainfall, you know, in February and March on these, you know, hills that have been burned out because there's nothing to hold back, there's no vegetation left, there's no roots to hold back mudslides. And so I think that will cause some really hard questions about, are these places where people really want to be building back at that same density with that same risk? I feel really terrible for the people who are going through this, especially lower income communities who don't necessarily have the resources to just up and move somewhere else, or who are living in these tight knit communities that go back decades. And I think it's really tragic, but we do have to be asking tough questions because of the climate crisis, because we have not stopped burning fossil fuels, about where it is safer and less safe to be building back.
Leah Stokes, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Associate Professor of Environmental Politics at the University of California, Santa Barbara, climate researcher. And I also want to thank Sonali Kahatkar, the well-known TV and radio broadcaster who does the show Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. Coming up next, we go to Gaza. We'll speak with journalist Aboubakar Abed. Burning by the AAS. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Gaza, where Israel's assault on the besieged strip continues despite ongoing talks over possible ceasefire. Palestinian authorities say 5,000 people are missing or have been killed in this first 100 days of Israel's siege of North Gaza. Since Monday morning, 33 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. Al Jazeera Arabic reports, including 5 people who died in an Israeli attack on a school sheltering displaced people in Gaza City. On Friday, Saeed Abu Navan, a Palestinian journalist for the Cairo-based Al-Ghad TV, was killed by Israeli forces while reporting in the Nusayrat refugee camp. His funeral held Saturday. This is his colleague, Mohammed Abu Namous.
It is clear that the Israeli occupation wants to target the journalist body that exposes its crimes. While the occupation has utilized its media to say that they only target the resistance and their weapons until the Palestinian journalists have exposed the truth to the world, saying this occupation targets children, women, and unarmed civilians.
The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate reports nearly 200 journalists have been killed in Israeli attacks since October 7, 2023. Over 400 others have been wounded or arrested. On Thursday, Palestinian journalists held a news conference outside Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, where they decried the hypocrisy and neglect of international media organizations. This is reporter Aboubakar Abed.
We are just documenting a genocide against us. It's enough after almost a year and a half. We want you to stand foot by foot with us because we are like any other journalists, reporters, and media workers all across the globe, no matter the origin, the color, or the race. Journalism is not a crime. We are not a target.
For more, journalist Abu Bakr Abed joins us now from Gaza. He used to be a soccer commentator, but now he calls himself an accidental war correspondent. His new piece for Dropsite News is headlined, "What It's Truly Like to Sleep in a Damp, Frigid Tent," a report from Gaza. He's joining us from Deir al-Balah, where that news conference was held. Abu Bakr Abed, thank you for joining us again. You're 22 years old. You didn't expect to be a war correspondent, but that's what you are now. Talk more about what you were demanding on Thursday, surrounded by other Palestinian journalists, demanding of the Western media, of all international journalists.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. So what I demanded was very simple, just the basic human rights as any other people across the globe, particularly for journalists here who have been subjected to sheer violence, brutality and barbarism over the past almost year and a half. Particularly if we talk about, if you have a bit of a comparison between us and any other journalists across the globe. And as I said in this press briefing, that we are working in makeshift tented camps and workplaces. I personally talk about myself here. I'm talking about myself here. Just I spent long hours of the day just trying to finalize a story or finalize a report just to tell people the truth. And sometimes we don't have the internet connection. We have been through starvation. We have been through freezing temperatures. We have been taking shelter in dilapidated tents. We haven't been given any sort of a human right at all. So this is what I really demanded. Because what I've been seeing for the past 14 months from international media outlets is absolutely enraging. Like, I do have the same rights. Like, what if we were in another spot in the world? The world would absolutely be standing with us and giving us everything we wanted. But why, when it comes to Palestinians, it's a completely different story. We understand that we've been taught as a young man, I've been always taught that the world cares about the human rights of every single person in the world. But I haven't seen any of those human rights as a Palestinian. What have I got to do with this war? So I was subjected to this scale of barbarism and this starvation and this, you know, cold and just all of these diseases. Even right now, while I'm talking to you, Amy, I've been diagnosed with a bronchitis. I'm still recovering from it. There are no right to proper medications inside any of the pharmacies here in Deir al-Balah, where more than a million people are taking shelter. Even if we talk about it in detail, the lack of medical supplies and aid inside the Al-Aqsa Matters Hospital here, which serves more than 1.5 million people in central Gaza, apart from the everyday casualties, is literally insane. When we talk about that, when we talk about the Palestinian journalists, we've lost around 210. And even after the press briefing, another journalist was killed. So you talk to an absolutely dead conscience of the world. You're talking about, the world just keeps turning a blind eye and a blind eye and just a deaf ear to what is happening as we are talking to ourselves. So it's completely enraging and unacceptable, because we are like, again, we are like any other reporters, media workers and journalists across the globe, and we have the right to be given the access to all media equipment, the access to the world, and our voices must be amplified. Because again, we don't have any party to this war, and we must be protected by all the international laws, because that's what has been enshrined in the international laws and the human rights that have always been taught to the entirety of the world.
We should make clear that all media has access to journalists on the ground in Gaza. Our Democracy Now! Viewers and listeners know we go regularly to Gaza, almost unheard of in the rest of the American corporate media. Yes, they are banned, and that should be raised every time they report on Israel and Gaza, that they are not allowed there. Abu Bakr Abed, what would it mean if there was more attention brought to the journalists on the ground in Gaza? According to a number of reports, well over 150, nearly 250 journalists have been killed, most recently this weekend in Nusayrat. Is that right, Abu Bakr?
Yes, I mean, like, the reports are always horrific. Even when we go to a particular place to report on a specific event in the continuously deteriorating a humanitarian situation, we know that death might be the end. We know that even everything we're doing right now to report on, or anything we're trying to tell, any story that we are trying to narrate to the outside world, is going to cost our lives. But we want to tell the world. We want to live in dignity. We want to live in peace and calm, because that's what we really deserve as any other people across the globe. But it just keeps going like this, because, like, again, you said it in the beginning that I shouldn't have been an accidental war correspondent, but that's what I've evolved into, because this is my homeland, and this is something that I have to defend wholeheartedly. But yes, even when I'm trying to do this, I'm not given the basic things. I'm not given the basic human rights. So every journalist here that is working tirelessly, that has been working relentlessly since the outbreak of this genocidal assault on Gaza, has faced an unimaginable horrors. We have, I myself lost my very dearest friend, lost family members, and lost many of my friends and many of my loved ones, but it's still, I still continue to hope, I still continue to endure the harsh, the stark realities of living inside Gaza, because Gaza is now the hellscape. Absolutely, it's the hell, the apocalyptic hellscape of the world. It's not livable at all. And children particularly, because I've been talking to many children and reporting on them, we can see that children are barefoot, they are traumatized, their clothes are ripped apart, and they are desperately needing just a sip of water and a bite of food, but that is not available, because Israel continues, continues applying the collective punishment on all people of the Gaza Strip. And again, I just want to reaffirm that, and I just want to reiterate it, which is that those, half of the Gaza population is children. So what have these children got to do with such a genocidal assault on Gaza? So they should have the right to educate, because they have been deprived of their education for the past year and a half, almost. And they have been deprived of, they have been deprived of every basic right, even their necessities and their childhood and everything about them. The same for us as young men. I should have completed my study. Unfortunately, my university has been reduced to rubble. Everything about Gaza, everything about my dreams, my memories, has also been razed to the ground and has also been reduced to ashes. So Israel does not have, amid the growing news of a possible ceasefire on the line, on the horizon, I can tell you that from here, that we are very hopeful. There is a state of optimism and anticipation for a ceasefire, because people, including me, want to heal up, want to let our wounds, our stretcher wounds, heal up, and we want to really have one moment of not hearing the buzzing sounds of the drones and the hovering of warplanes, particularly during the night hours, because the thoughts every single day, we are very much traumatized, and we really need rehabilitation to really get to our lives, to get to who we were before this war started. So it's a very much needed thing, because people are really crying for it. People are really hopeful about it, and I hope that this will not dash their hopes, the continuous attacks on Gaza, and I hope that they will have their dreams coming true very, very soon in the coming days.
Abu Bakr, Abed, we want to thank you so much for being with us. 22-year-old journalist speaking to us from Deir al-Balah, Gaza. Used to be a soccer commentator, now, as he calls himself, an accidental war correspondent. Coming up next, we look at an effort to hold individual Israeli soldiers accountable for war crimes. Back in 20 seconds.
لازم نحكي عن اللي كان واللي حيكون وعزك يدوم على سما بتبرق نجوم يا صبر طويل مهما طال الليل مش حنكمل فيه لأنها بلدنا وحتضلها حلوة
Balada by El Farai and Rhoda Azar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with a look at a new effort to hold Israeli soldiers accountable despite a climate of impunity for crimes committed in Gaza. Last week, Poland adopted a resolution ensuring that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be guaranteed safe entry to Poland to attend ceremonies marking 80 years since the liberation of the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz. Poland's deputy foreign minister had said earlier Poland would comply with the International Criminal Court's arrest warrants if Netanyahu visited Poland. Here in the U.S., the House of Representatives voted last week to sanction the International Criminal Court over arrest warrants for Netanyahu and the former military chief, Yoav Gallant. But in Belgium, a nonprofit called the Hind Rajab Foundation filed a lawsuit Thursday against an Israeli soldier in Sweden who they accuse of playing a direct role in the targeting of civilians and destruction of homes. Earlier this month, Israel's embassy in Brazil helped a 21-year-old Israeli Army reservist flee Brazil after a Brazilian federal court ordered police to open an investigation into possible war crimes he committed in Gaza. That case had also been filed by the Hind Rajab Foundation. The Brussels-based nonprofit is named after 6-year-old Hind Rajab, who was killed along with her family in a January 2024 Israeli attack as they were in a car escaping bombardment in Gaza City, a story we covered extensively. For more, we're joined now in Brussels by Diab Abujaja, co-founder of the Hind Rajab Foundation. Diab, thank you for joining us. Explain what you are calling for. Talk about the Brazilian case and also the one in Sweden and where you get your information about what these Israeli soldiers specifically have done.
Thank you, Amy. Thanks for having me. Indeed, as you said in your presentation, our mission is seeking accountability, seeking justice, basically. It is a sad thing that citizens as ourselves should be doing this, because normally this should be an automatic thing that states and legal bodies, international legal bodies, should be seeking. However, it is, of course, our right as citizens to do that when these countries mostly default on their responsibilities. So what we do is monitor the posts of Israeli soldiers who have been extensively, as you know and everybody knows, posting things out of Gaza, out of the ongoing genocide there. And we look for criminal activity because, obviously we only target soldiers who have posted things of themselves that we consider, legally speaking, as war crimes, at least, and maybe more than war crimes. So this is the every research we do is open intelligence, open source intelligence. So this is how we function. Once we have evidence, we pass it to our legal teams. They prepare cases and then they file it when when the subject enters a country where that has jurisdiction, or let's say activating jurisdiction of that country over these things. So this is what happened in Brazil. This is what happened before Brazil in Cyprus as well, and also as you mentioned in Sweden. So this is basically our way of operating.
We only have a minute, but can you talk about the Brazil case of the Israeli soldier and, again, how you get the information about what they specifically did?
Again, the information is posted by themselves, so we analyze it and we turn social media posts basically into legal cases. I just want to, since you said we just have a minute, I want to take the opportunity to say that the countries of the world should take their responsibilities. As we speak, Major Ghassan Alian, who is the head of COGAT, which is the entity that oversees the weaponizing of famine in Gaza, is present in Italy to attend a meeting secretly. Have filed a case against them in the International Criminal Court, asking them to activate any arrest warrant that they have against them, or if not, issue a new one. And we also informed the Italian authorities, asking them to activate their responsibility under the Rome Statute, which since they have jurisdiction and since Major General Alian does not have immunity. This is an example that is now unfolding of how the countries of this world should take their responsibilities. And, I think the Brazilian case was a case where that happened, where a judge actually issued a probe order to investigate a soldier Unfortunately, the Israeli government smuggled the soldier out of Brazil, which is, of course, obstructing justice. But we are continuing. We are relentless in seeking justice, and we are...
It about, baby. You ask why the blues had to go and pick you. So you go down to the shore, kid stuff. Don't you know there's honey in store for you? Big stuff, let's take a ride in my gravy train. The doors open wide, come in from out of